brands are important to be in their own space. Again, the best example is Apple. You go to an Apple store and you feel the power of the brand.
To me, Masalan, even sitting here in this in my office, if this is not comfortable to me and to you and not pleasing to the eye, I find the conversation shifts.
Dry, yeah, absolutely.
By hospitality, do you mean hotels?
I'm not going to compete with you. Don't worry.
You're more than welcome to acquire the whole thing.
Yeah? No.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hashim Montasser, and this is the Lighthouse Conversations, a podcast featuring entrepreneurs from the world of arts, culture, tech, and food. If you're joining us for the first time today, you can follow the show on any of your podcast players like Apple, Spotify, or Anghami, or go to YouTube for the video version. Make sure to hit the follow button to get alerted when we have a new episode. You can also listen to our extensive catalog of previous episodes in your podcast app or on our website at thelighthouse.ae/podcast. I'm joined today by Eli Khoury, CEO of Vivium Holding and chairman of Omnicom Media Group MENA. Eli's interests overlapped with many of the topics we've covered in the show over the years. He's curious about technology, design, obviously art. He's a big art collector. And to use his own words, all things beautiful. Eli, who grew up in Beirut, made Dubai his home over 30 years ago. And kicking off an illustrious career in media and eventually leading Omnicom Media Group as a CEO. In 2017, he launched Vivium Holding as a family office, specializing in alternative investing. There's a lot to unpack here. From Eli's early years in Beirut, his shift to media, his more recent shift to doing his own thing, his love affair with art and design, and last but not least, becoming a shark on the first season of Shark Tank Dubai. Welcome, Eli. It's a honor to have you here. This has been in the making for some time. I have had such an interest in bringing you onto the podcast because you've had one of these very unusual trajectories in terms of your career. So I'm going to jump right in. One of the things that we talked about before in the podcast has been typically entrepreneurs that start a business or, you know, build up a business. You've done something very unusual is you were started and climbed up the corporate ladder, so to speak. And I think you'll tell us more about how that happened. And then pivoted and started your own business as a second career, so to speak. And that's not something you see much in the Middle East. You see people who are very successful, corporate careers, people who are entrepreneurs that build a business and become very successful. You have married the two. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I grew up in a tough environment. I grew up in the war, in the civil war in Lebanon. And, you know, what wars mean, it's a lot of hardship, a lot of, issues in terms of surviving.
Did you grow up in Beirut or somewhere else?
I grew up in Beirut.
Okay.
So I had to, during my childhood, I come from a very modest family. So I had to kind of find ways to make money, to survive, to do my thing as an adult. So I started early on my entrepreneurship journey, if you like.
Give us some examples.
Selling, you know, doing all sorts of silly things.
Like what?
You know.
No, we would be curious.
Selling firecrackers is one of the things I really enjoy doing. Selling canned food in the neighbors during when food wasn't very accessible, finding ways of sourcing the food.
And how did you source?
I used to go to, you know, the wholesalers and then find them in certain areas and then go and sell them, you know, knock on doors and sell them one at a time.
So you know? Understood the wholesale retail concept even from even then.
During
wars, Tegar Gomla, yeah, you buy at this price and you sell to Yari. That says something about you.
I even used to do sometimes shoe shine for family members just to get some side money on the side. So it's been part of me. I wanted to leave Lebanon after the war, so I went to Cyprus, and this is where it all started for me. And I started with Omnicom, as you said. I've been in the same company, I'm still in the same company for 30 years now, 30 plus years. And how do you do that? Because again, you don't think of a company as somebody else's company. You think of it as it's your own company. And once you do so, your mindset shifts to, this is mine. I have to make it happen. I have to succeed.
Can I go back for a second here? Just that we have the full story. So you obviously went to university in Beirut.
I went to university in Beirut.
You graduated and was Omnicom, or the original version of Omnicom, so to speak, your first job out of university?
I did my BA and then I did my MBA. In between, okay. I did finance. So I did a couple of years of finance.
Okay.
And I realized this wasn't for me. Okay. You know? And then I wanted to try something else. I was walking in the streets of Beirut. I bumped into a friend of mine and he said, I told him, what are you doing? He was with me at uni. And he said, I'm doing advertising. And I said, what is that? I mean, what's advertising? During the days. And he said, we do cool things. We go to meetings with clients. We travel. We do shoots. We do commercials. I said, that sounds cool. Yeah. So I said, let me give it a shot. So I, you know, as kids, we didn't know what we wanted to do. And I think a lot of people struggle with that, and it's okay. So I applied to get two job offers, one in Cyprus, one in Athens. And I chose Cyprus because it gave me $50 more at the time in terms of salary. So that's how it started.
And this was at Omnicom. What was BBDO. The first PBDO at the time? Yeah.
So advertising, because media at the time wasn't exactly. wasn't anything. So advertising was very, you know, madman.
Old school, yeah.
Madman, you know, cool, very, very Hollywoodish and very fancy. So I started there as a account executive trainee, you know. And I was very annoyed with the trainee. And I told him, hey, I have an MBA. Why do you call me trainee? But then that was the whole thing. You had to start really from the bottom.
Many people that are creative, and obviously you have a creative bent, we'll get into that a bit later, find corporate stifling. They don't thrive there. They can work there for a while, but they don't thrive there. And I've had my own experience with that because it tends to be political. It tends to be, it takes a particular personality. How did you navigate at Omnicom all these years to rise pretty much all the way to the top?
First of all, they allowed me to be myself. They allowed me to be an entrepreneur
within
a corporate environment. Launch my own units, hire the people I wanted to hire, do my own thing. As long as I delivered, they let me be.
And when you say they, was that specific to you or was it specific to the company culture?
It was specific to the company culture.
Okay.
I mean, Omnicom is a pretty much... you know, get on with your thing, do well, and then fine.
We leave you alone as long as,
you deliver. If you deliver, fine. If
so that worked very well for you.
You're out. So as long as you deliver, it was okay. So I did that for, of course, I grew. I moved from BBDO to launch the media company for Omnicom back in 2000. At the time, it was a startup, but we never called it a startup because nobody spoke about startups. But it was 8 people that got together to do something great.
Where was that?
That was in Dubai in 2000. So this is how we launched Omnicom Media Group.
And how did you survive what you said? You started off with the Mad Men era, let's call it that for a second. And then digitization came and a completely different business model, quite literally appended the business models. Today, when you look at advertising from your or my days growing up, when we used to get a fat magazine and that's when you knew something was doing well, to today, which is almost entirely digital. Many, many companies didn't make this.
It was tough getting to understand how the shift is happening.
That's
and
exactly
how fast
right.
is happening. Don't forget, I was in advertising. And advertising, our role at the time was service clients and shoot commercials. And again, shoot commercials because it was all about TV. So the 30-second commercial, how you go on and shoot, how you do the casting. So our job is really deliver TV content.
Yes.
But then you realize through the time that clients' attention was shifting from creating content to monetization, to performance.
Yes.
That was early 2000.
Yes, correct.
And when the whole shift was important for clients to say, how can I quantify what I'm doing? You know, the whole, you know, old say, I spend 50% of my money. I don't know.
Which is how you had double click, which essentially became Google, which really was the engine.
So that was the beginning of quantification, performance, numbers, KPIs, etc. And this is when I realized advertising isn't going to be the place for me. And I wanted to do something else. So I go to Omnicom, say, let me launch the media company. But hey, you know nothing about media, but it's fine. So what? You know? So that's how we started. So I got around me great people who knew what they're talking about when it comes to media. And we launched the company.
What do you think made you see this trend? Was it you were curious? You were following trends? Because a lot of people, when you're in it, and many, many companies, as you well know, stuck to their old business, especially when the old business is a cash cow. I mean, lots of these businesses are great businesses, right? classified businesses, fantastic business for newspaper. So many of them held on to it. Was it that you were following technologies or you're hanging around with a lot different people in it, or just your curiosity?
Everybody has opportunities. We all have opportunities. But I think very few people see the opportunities
and act on them.
So I think I took a risk. I mean, everybody was saying you're crazy. I mean, you're in a very stable job. I was a partner at the time in a very stable, you know, industry. Why would you want to leave it to try something completely new? But then again, I saw something and, you know, it worked.
And that media company of 8 people is how many people today?
Now it's about 1,000 people, you know.
And that's the heart of the company.
Yeah, that's absolutely. And again, we grew from maybe $20 million of work to over $1 billion today. Of course, you know, the market grew with us and, you know, we did things right. But then that gives you a sense of, you know, satisfaction that something good happened.
But even that wasn't enough. So at some point you decided.
I've always said you have to leave at the peak of your career. You cannot. I've stayed in the company for 30 years. I've done well. And all the time I was, again, because of my nature, I was doing things on the side. I was like investing left, right, and center. And we'll come to that in a bit. But then you reach a point where you say there's a great bunch of people that have grown with you. They deserve to, you know, lead the company. And, you know, I've got to do something else. And the industry, and again, you're part of Omnicom, you're part of a holding company. At a point in time, it becomes corporate. No matter what you do with Wall Street, with numbers, it becomes very, you know, delivering monthly. Then becomes a bit, you know, unlike what I wanted to do. So I told them I've got to step down. And it took, you know, 4 or 5 years of transition. And, you know, there's a great team in place today. The company is doing well. So, of course, we speak about the pivots. You know, what am I doing today?
Can I interrupt you 1 second before you go into what you're doing today? As I think these pivots are very important. Because now that I understand it a bit better, there were several pivots even within the company that you've done, obviously. I mean, starting a media company in the early 2000s, when you have a very stable job and you're a partner. So there's something I talk about quite a lot on the show, and I want to get your view on this. Is it that you don't have a fear of failure, or is it that the fear of failure for you is not significant enough to you not to make those turns? Because for you to all of a sudden say, this has been great, I'm going to move on to my second career, can call it whatever you want, that's what it is, you could fall. And you've built a name, you've built a brand for yourself and for the company. Does that occur to you when you make these pivots, or
when
you're zero fear?
Successful. I don't want to
Yes.
When definitely. You've done it and you've succeeded in doing it a couple of times, a few times, there's no fear. Because you always say, I'm going to do it. I've done it before, I'm going to do it.
Do you simulate what could happen if you don't succeed, or it doesn't even occur?
No. Think about it.
You don't think about it.
Because that's the whole thing about, you don't think of fear. There's no fear. There's just something you believe in and you go for it.
Okay.
And you go for it all the way. And again, I've done several pivots. The first pivot is leaving a country. The second pivot is, leaving an industry. I was in finance. Okay, so I left finance to something completely, what is that, advertising? Then leaving the country, then leaving advertising to media, and then leaving something super stable when I was the CEO and shareholder. I was shareholder in the company.
Sure.
To say, it's enough. I've done enough of that. I've accumulated,
enough resources,
experience to get on with something else completely new. And that's hopefully the last pivot.
Well, let's talk
There's
about
no more pivot.
Because I think this has been very interesting to me, and I've been following this from the outside. So you started this new company. So tell us about the company. Tell us about this pivot.
It's not a company per se.
It's a family office. Family office.
Which is a hybrid between a family office and a holding structure. Because family offices tend to be very discreet, very hush-hush. You don't know. There's a lot of, given my background in brand building and marketing, I've always been passionate about building brands. So I said to myself, I cannot just be very silent. I need to create a brand. And again, it's a way of doing things differently.
Yes.
It's a way of attracting people to come to a great place to work, to come to be part of something, a mission, something that, we're here to do something, not just creating wealth. but having fun also.
And there's an element here too, by doing it so publicly. I mean, you know, typically when you go and try to Google a family holding, family office, you find nothing. You know, you find maybe one page and there's nothing in there. You have, it's all there. It's out there. The silos are there. Now, one of the interesting things I thought about is by being so public about it, people can also track the names, the brands, the success. So again, it's a testament to you that you're not hiding. And if you're a family office and some things go awry and it's not publicized, no one's going to find out, frankly. You might be upset, but that's it. But Sir Naharda went out and you've built these silos or building them. It's out there. I think that's great because you're showing people the way of how this is done.
It's a way also to demonstrate that you can do things differently.
Yes.
You're using the word silos. I don't want to use silos because silos means complete isolation.
I use
verticals. I like verticals because verticals allows fluidity between those things. To go back to why we're doing differently. A family office typically is about passive investment. So you have an amount of money, you have certain wealth that you've created, and how you manage that wealth in a passive way through public equity, through private equity, through investing, through having analysts and what have you. I've decided to go into much more active investing, which is creating companies from scratch, creating business from scratch. And I think that's what I enjoy doing, the act of creating and
so
creating
multiple
value.
Multiple businesses at the same
multiple
time.
Multiple businesses.
I which decided, are what? What are
I decided
the verticals?
Those to be three, actually.
Okay.
Typically, people create one and they spend time.
Of course.
Because my nature said, you know, let's do some of them. So the first one is a design business.
Okay.
And again, I started with Cassina. So bringing, again, loving brands. Cassina is an amazing brand. So we brought Cassina to Dubai. It was here, but we gave it a home. So we gave it identity, we gave it shape.
And a beautiful retail location, which you didn't have before.
And a great architecture as well. So marrying the inside and the outside. So Cassina is the beginning. Then there's Catal that's following with a monobrand, Giorgetti and Rimadesio, and more to come. So I'm creating a design business, hopefully, and of course, in the future, there will be one-of-one or collectible design that's going to be part of that. And hopefully creating a culture of design in Dubai.
Can I pause at this first vertical for a second? Because I think it's important and it's something that I'm also very passionate about as a design lover and collector for many years. Design is experiential, ultimately.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I find interesting about what you're doing is, at I'm sure a great expense, you are creating, as you said, it's a very good word, homes for these brands. Because I think you understand viscerally that the experiential feel of it is very important.
Absolutely.
You know, for to me, Masalan, even sitting here in this in my office, if this is not comfortable to me and to you and not pleasing to the eye, I find the conversation shifts.
Dry, yeah, absolutely.
A bit different. I just think it's a bit different. And I have felt with a lot of design, collectible design in the region, that has been the issue. So many of us will go abroad, experience the brand as it should be, quote unquote, and then maybe come buy it here from, you know, a place.
A retailer, yeah.
A retailer, or a wholesaler even.
Yeah.
And I feel that's a big disservice to both international brands like the Cassinas and the Catals, and even to local brands. So I'm encouraging you, if you are able to be one of those investors that help us build that and close that gap, I think that's very important.
I think it's happening at the right time because Dubai is undergoing a shift as well, to be honest. You know, brands are important to be in their own space. Again, the best example is Apple. You go to an Apple store and you feel the power of the brand. I mean, again, it's large spaces, beautifully crafted spaces, design. And again, you see the products, but you feel different. So I think Dubai, after COVID, is a different country. I mean, it has completely been transformed. People used to be here living in a transitory way. Today, people are moving in and staying and saying, this is where I'm going to be, you know. And more people are moving here and buying homes. And with that comes the whole idea of buying design furniture and investing because it's an investment, because these things stay for a long time.
So you think there's now a higher appreciation of that than it was a decade ago?
There is, because
when many of us wanted that, but maybe it was too early.
You know, buying home before was not accessible. Everybody today is buying their own home. So when you buy your own home, you want to make it clearly yours. You want to make it feel homey. So you add your own furniture, you add your own art, your own design, and again, you make it like your own personality.
Makes sense. So vertical number one is design.
So design is one. You know, number two is, again, we don't want to make them so structured, one and two.
No.
But the second thing I love is real estate. So in real estate, there's a bunch of things, you know. Sotheby's is another brand. So we took Sotheby's 10 years ago, my partner and I. And Sotheby's real estate. And my partner led the company and I was supporting him from the back. Sotheby's is a great brand. It's another brand that we invested in. So there's Sotheby's in real estate. There's hospitality, which is something new. And again, that's the second business that I'm passionate about because it blends all the things that interest me. Architecture, design, art, you know, hospitality, all of these things are great.
By hospitality, do you mean hotels or
hotels?
What?
Okay. I'm not going to compete with you. Don't worry.
You're more than welcome to acquire the whole thing.
No.
We're ready.
I'm talking about hotels because hotels is.
I'm curious because hospitality can mean a lot of things. That's what I'm saying.
So within that, of course, I'm gonna. It's about buying the assets first, acquiring the asset, and then getting operators on board. And again, I'm learning.
Yes.
I'm not an expert. In hospitality. But again, my ambition is to create my hospitality brand. You know, like Lighthouse is a brand that you've created.
Thank you.
And, you know,
we can build the Lighthouse Hotel together, by
Let's
the way.
Let's do it. Yeah, that's a good idea.
No, I would love
that's
that.
That's a
idea.
Good idea.
Because, you know, I always said, that Dubai has so many hotels. And yet, when you look at boutique hotels, there's almost.
They don't exist.
Don't exist, which is frankly strange.
I'm working with the branding agency now to really create the brand. And hopefully it's something we'll launch soon. Not in Dubai, because again, Dubai is a complex place. There's too much competition and, you know, so in Europe. So I'm working for that to happen in Europe. So hospitality is the second vertical. And the third vertical is what you call collectibles. Collectibles is art, design, a bunch of other collectibles. I even collect Apple products. Since Apple Computer 1, 2, I have the first iPhone, iPad, you know, keyboards, you name it. So there's a bunch of stuff.
What sparked this passion in collecting?
You know, everybody asks me this question, why do you collect? And I don't know why, you know, to be honest, it's just something that makes you feel good. I mean, having things you enjoy living with and, you know, it's not an investment. I don't think you collect to invest. You just collect because you love collecting.
When we come back, Eli tells me about his experience on the first season of Shark Tank Dubai and his tips for all of you budding entrepreneurs out there. That's right after the short break. Welcome back. You're listening to the Lighthouse Conversations with my guest, Eli Khoury. I read somewhere that you said, which I think it's kind of nice. You were saying, they were asking, what defines a collector? You said, well, when you don't have enough wall space,
absolutely.
That probably means you're finally now a collector. So obviously you have maxed out your wall space a long time ago.
Absolutely.
So talk to me about the evolution of your collecting.
The question is, they asked me, when did you start collecting?
And yes.
When did you start collecting seriously? Because you've always collected. Even when you were a child, during your teenager, you always had things on your wall, a poster here, something you buy when you're traveling on holiday.
Things that make you feel good.
So you always buy things. But when you start when I started collecting seriously is when I started to buy 10, 15, 20 pieces of work per year. And again, it becomes an addiction. That was about 15 years ago. And I was triggered by Art Dubai, actually, when I was here. I saw a piece of work that attracted me. It was expensive for me at the time. And I said, I'm going to do it. So that was, you know, let's go for it. I had a good bonus at the time.
That's great.
Let me buy it.
Great.
So it spoke to me. You know, the title was So Happy to See You. It was full of
Nabil Nahas.
Nabil Nahas. So it was full of life. You know, I loved it. So I bought it. And then it makes you go more to art fairs, more to museums, more to shows, more to galleries, and then you discover that there's a lot of great work out there, a lot of great creatives.
Do you focus on any particular medium, you know, you know, photography, sculptures,
everything, installation,
conceptual, non-conceptual, decorative.
I'm more on the visual, less conceptual.
Okay.
Conceptual is fine, but I like something that speaks to me, that is strong, that is bold, that is colorful on the wall. So from photography to sculptures to paintings to installations. I don't have a lot of videos, but I should. And I think, but again, videos is more institutional because you need to display it in the right context. So hopefully we'll get into that.
Are there in the Middle East specifically particular artists? And obviously you come from a country that's been blessed with amazing artists over the years. Any particular artists that speak to you beyond Nabil Nahas?
I'm always accused of not supporting a lot the Middle Eastern again, supporting is a big word because
it is a big word.
You know, you have to buy what you love.
Tough to speak to you.
It's not about buying Middle Eastern or African or American. It's again, you see a lot of stuff because I travel a lot and I always buy what talks to me.
Speaks to you.
Of course, a lot of Middle Eastern artists I buy as well and talk to me. I mean, there's many of them. Etel Adnan, Uged Kalan, Baalbaki, Nabil Nahas, Laurence. As well.
After a certain point, I mean, collecting, I mean, how do you think about that evolution today? In other words, I mean, you know the taste, I think, of the things that speak to you. Do you find any particular themes that have popped up, maybe even subconsciously? I did this exercise with a mutual friend, Rania, some years back, and I found it almost like therapy. You know, because I kind of had a sense of certain themes, but I really hadn't taken the time to go and think about it. And all of a sudden, certain themes that are very subconscious to me started popping up. Have you experimented with that?
Well, of course, we've done it. Because, again, you buy.
Exactly.
And you buy and then you say, okay, let me make sense out of it all. What am I buying? What do I really like? And then you put them back, you put them on the wall, and you start to
see a theme.
Segment them, say, okay, this is more about appropriation. This is more about history. This is more about race, this is more about gender, this is more about portraiture, this is more about abstraction. And again, there's a cross between them sometimes. So, and then you make sense of it all. And then if you look at it, there's a lot of bold abstraction in my collection. So I happen to like something bold and I like it to be a bit more structured. Gunter Fohr kind of, you know, work. And there's a lot of figurative work. Why? Because I see storytelling and figuration. Again, when I see a few characters in a painting or one or two, I create my own stories. And again, that's why it becomes fun, because I see my story. And again, everyone has a story. And there's a way of talking about it when you're around people about, you know, how you share your stories with them.
Maybe your background in media and advertising is giving you this. That I think the storytelling element of it.
Advertising is about, everything is about storytelling, actually. You know, everything in life is about how you tell your story, how you communicate, and how you say it with persuasion, with conviction. And I think you can tell a story about everything that you see, and art is a big example of that. It's a way of also changing the work. It's a way of living with different work and creating different stories. Because again, putting two works next to each other says something else about the works rather than if you put them differently as well on the walls.
And how do you think all of this in terms of storytelling jives and interacts with the new Dubai, as you said? So Dubai, I agree with you, has sort of essentially post-COVID hit escape velocity, as they say. You know, it's a very different city than it was the one we experienced 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
30 years ago for me.
30 years. I've been here 20 plus years. Amazing. I have a feeling that some of the business you're setting up seem to drive and correspond very well to this new chapter that you're seeing in Dubai and in the UAE. Has that been a conscious?
Yeah, absolutely. Dubai is today the mirror of the Middle East. It's like the place where things are happening and the center of the Middle East, actually a bit more than the Middle East. So Dubai merits its own space, its own, if you like, identity. What you do in Dubai is seen globally.
Yes.
Today, Dubai is compared to Miami, compared to the big cities in the world. And actually, it merits that. And there is a need for brands to be here and be shown in a big way.
Do you have an interest also in building brands from scratch? So, you know, or
I do. Again, the hospitality is one example.
Okay. Yeah.
We spoke about collectible design.
Yes.
So that's going to be a separate brand also, a new brand. And again, bringing the best design from all over the world, one of ones or collectible design. That's going to be a completely new brand. And there will be a few others.
So collectible design in the region, as you know, in Dubai specifically, has had a checkered history. 10, 15 years ago, when Art Dubai started doing design fair and they tried to do it, it really wasn't a very big success. I think it was too early. So I guess, part of the question that you feel today the time is right? I remember at the time, you know, and then it, to be very frank, and I've had people here on the show that have, curated the design fair here as well, Cyril and others. We spoke about the timing. And I felt it shifted from being what wanted to be a collectible design to, frankly, more of a trade show. There's nothing wrong with that. I think it's been very successful.
I think they do both.
Now they do both. But do you feel the timing now is right for collectible design?
The timing is better now. Again, why? Because there are the people that are willing to collect design. Again, it's all about collectors. You know, when they started 10 years ago, I think there were not enough collectors in Dubai. The same for art. You know, for every fair to be successful, you need the people to go there and say, I'm going to buy this thing. You know, and again, that culture of buying and collecting is new, and it takes time for it to progress.
So would it warrant to have two different shows, one that's more of a trade fair and one that's more of a collectible design fair?
Absolutely. The trade show is a trade show. Exactly. It's about furniture accessories and and collectible design. It's a bit like art. I would advocate that it should happen at the same time as Art Dubai.
But be two separate.
Because they're the same type of collectors who buy both.
That's very interesting. Instead of doing it with a trade fair, it would be with Art Dubai as a design fair.
Absolutely.
And art fair, like you see with
and
many.
And that's how
the
Basel happens. That's how, you know, of course, in London or Paris, you have PAD, which is also just a design fair. But the culture of collecting in Europe is
much
way
more
advanced than we are here. So here we need to marry it with the art fair and put them together to create more synergy between them.
We've had some other friends of ours that have been on the show that are Lebanese. Some of them were living in Beirut when the explosion happened. And many of them moved to Dubai or had been living in Dubai but experienced different ways. Talk to us a little bit about your experience, because obviously as a Lebanese who has been in Dubai for 30 years, did that change something in you? Because I have had with many of them that feeling that it really did.
I was here for a long time. So actually, I'm not going to lie to you.
Distant.
Yeah, I felt, I'm distant from, okay, unfortunately.
Nothing fortunate or unfortunate. I'm just curious. I was not in Egypt when the revolution happened either. But definitely, you know, you feel something. Maybe not the same thing that they feel living there.
I lived a war for 10 years, 12 years as a child. You know, it was... Yeah. It was horrible as well. No electricity, no food, living in shelter, being bombed all the time. So it's a bit, you know, also not pleasant. Again, I'm not comparing, better. But again, I'm distant from, unfortunately, what's happening in Lebanon. I consider what's happening to be unfortunate. I don't relate as much as I do to the country. Dubai is home for me now, and I'm happy with that.
When you look at the GCC, how much do you, a lot of talk about Dubai versus Riyadh versus, my personal view is I feel they're all complementing each other. And there is a role for all of them, actually, and for the whole region to grow as a result of that.
Absolutely.
Do you feel the same way, or do you feel there is more of a competitive element?
I think the governments are kind of positioning it as such. I mean, you know, to be fair, Saudi is trying to compete with Dubai. And I think that's wrong. I agree with you. It's a completely different culture, completely different country. If you go to Dubai, you have, or UAE, it's a very versatile demographic. You have 90% expats or 85% expats. When you go to Saudi, it's a very local country, whereas the other way around. So it's not comparable. And the lifestyle will not be comparable. So let's stop comparing, for God's sake.
I agree with that.
Riyadh is Riyadh, Dubai is Dubai, Abu Dhabi is Abu Dhabi.
And we need all of them.
And Qatar is Qatar. So great. I mean, what's great is from a cultural point of view that they're all investing in culture. They're all trying to do something. And it's amazing. I think what's happening.
I think that's right.
What's happening in Saudi in terms of investment that they're doing in culture and museum is amazing. Here also, Abu Dhabi, the cultural district is something that will shape up to be a great place as well. Sharjah Biennale is one of the best biennales. Yeah. Art Dubai and the whole ecosystem of the gallery. So we have a complementary, something happening.
When it comes to entrepreneurship, you are on Shark Tank.
Oh, yes.
How was the experience versus your expectation going in?
Better.
Okay.
I thought it would be much more difficult, actually. Okay. It was fun. Okay. It was really fun. It was exhausting because we used to shoot between 4 and sometimes 11 p.m. Daily, so people don't see it on TV because but it was hard, it was harder to do it in Arabic because again in business we speak always in English, so getting used to pictures in Arabic and trying to find the business words that go along these things was a bit harder, but I think we
and how was the was talent fun. That was being showcased.
Look, the season one was okay. I think it takes time to build
up
the understanding of the program because the culture of Shark Tank in the US, they've been doing it for, I think, 11 years or 12 years. Yes. So I think I'm pretty sure that season one and two in the US were not as good as season 10 or 11. I think we've done pretty well for season one. I think season two would be much more interesting because now there's demand. There's a lot of demand for people to go on the show and pitch.
And the region needs more of that. What advice would you give young entrepreneurs? We talked about this a little bit offline.
Yeah.
There's definitely the talent here. And, I feel, in my own journey, I've had my ups and downs, but I still think that I launch this, as you are doing now, as a second career. I still think it's very, very hard, incredibly hard, in fact, to start off as an entrepreneur. Because I think that it still requires many things, not just financial resources, many things. And the region has improved drastically, but we're not yet there.
We're not there. Absolutely.
What do you feel, what advice would you give today to young entrepreneurs that want to start up?
I think what the first thing they have to do is assess themselves. Am I an entrepreneur?
It's a very good point.
Because it's not, beyond the sexiness, not everybody is an entrepreneur. Yes. A lot of people should be in the corporate world. Very few should be entrepreneurs because, again, the mix is not the same.
And the failure rate is staggering, statistically.
95%.
9 out of 10, essentially.
Never, you have different results. Failure, depending on what failure is to you. Getting out of business, going out of business, or barely surviving. So am I an entrepreneur? What does it mean? Can I work hard, really hard? Can I sustain myself without income for 4 or 5 years? Because again,
sometimes more,
or 6 years or 10 years. Can I get people around me that are amazing as I am? Can I get funding? Can I convince people to finance me? Because I'm going to need their money for years and years before I start to break even or make money. So there's a lot of complexity. So that's what I start. But then again, I would say to entrepreneurs, don't be alone. Mm. Don't start something on your own. Because it's tough. Mm. Get like-minded people like you, two co-founders or three co-founders, the rates of success are higher always. And again, be consistent. Do it as your only job, because a lot of entrepreneurs, they want to do two or three things or do a job on the side. I think you have to be all in.
You have to be all in.
All in 24/7. And then hopefully you'll make it.
100%. I mean, you were asking me earlier if I do anything beyond the lighthouse. And I was telling you, I think you cannot run these businesses if you're not all in. It just doesn't work. And from the outside, it doesn't feel like sometimes a lot of work, but it's also not just the physical work. It's the amount of brain power and energy it takes.
You have to be focused. Yes. We got a lot of entrepreneurs on Shark Tank that were doing two jobs. And we said, no way.
Cut the job.
We can't support you unless you leave your job, your current employment, to get on the entrepreneurship bandwagon properly.
And we've seen, obviously, Dubai has made some amazing strides supporting entrepreneurs. If there's one thing that you would like to see that you still think we don't have here in terms of supporting them, I'm not talking about capital, because I think, as you said, capital is about matching yourself up with the right people that will support your long-term journey. Yes. I don't think that's the government's job, in my view. Now, they can do it if they want to, but that's not. Is there one thing that stands out to you that you feel would make a big difference in entrepreneurial journeys here, if you had it?
To be honest with you, the government has done what the government can do. Provide sometimes support, financial support, provide the ecosystem with the accelerators, with the facilitation in terms of visas and what have you. I don't think it's for governments to do more. I think it's for the investment communities and the individuals to really succeed and to break through. And again, the more you have great, I think it's all about ideas and what you're trying to do and how you're changing the world around you. And I think when you have a great idea and you have a great team, you're going to get funding because people are going to come to you and say, you're amazing. We love what you do. And here's the money to invest. So I think, and again, people and money will come from international investors as well and VCs from abroad. And more of that is happening.
Now, the one obstacle that we see, I see at least as somebody who also invests in startups, is exits. You know, so globally, I mean, one of the reasons the US is such a terrific market for startups is, okay, it shuts sometimes down, but by and large, there are viable and many ways of exiting. We're exiting via going public, exiting via M&A acquisitions, exiting many, many, many ways.
Absolutely.
Here, we have not seen many exits. Let's be honest, when you talk about the last 10 years, I've seen a jump in entrepreneurship and startups, technology and beyond, but still, exits are far and beyond. So as an investor, how do you feel about that? Because ultimately, you have one dirham, and that dirham has to go far, and you have to sweat it. So you cannot, you know, if you're going to have to lock it up for 20 years with no prospect.
Hopefully not 20.
No,
hopefully
I'm
10.
I'm exaggerating.
Hopefully 10. I think those investing in startups or VC, the VC model of, have to know that this should be 5 to 10% of their investments. So if you have a portfolio investments, you should allocate a very small amount of money towards that investment. Why? Because it's long-term and there's no liquidity opportunities. So once you invest in a startup or VC funds, you have to be patient and wait years and years and expect that this money will not come back to you, or some of it will start coming back to you in year 5 onwards, because this is when it pays back. So that's VCs. Yes. If you invest individually in startups, and I don't invest that people do so, because you need diversification. Ah. Because in a portfolio of 20 companies in a fund, one of them makes it in a big way. 3 or 4 would barely succeed.
And the rest.
And the other ones would fail. So naturally, and again, it's very tough to bet on the one that's going to make it. So it's better always to be diversified. So the issue is liquidity, because again, the culture of supporting startups here, again, is very new in this and the Arab world. So that's going to take a while, but that's growing. That's moving in the right
direction. And the liquidity, you think, will come from what? More companies acquiring those startups? Or
absolutely.
IPOs?
I think IPOing is a long shot.
Yeah, I agree. For now.
We don't have the scale, because to IPO, you need scale. And here, we're still fragmented. There's Dubai, there's Saudi, there's Egypt, there's Lebanon, small countries. You know, for you to have scale, of course, you need to be available in many markets. So you have to be pan-Arab, if not global or regional, for you to have scale to be able to IPO. So that's the difficulty.
What about one idea that I find very interesting, the Saudis and Abu Dhabi are doing this too, is having an SME public market. In other words, smaller companies can go in public and then you circumvent this issue of scale. It's early days.
It's early days.
I think it's interesting because I agree with you. Not every company can become an Aramex. I mean, it's not realistic.
But Aramex went public and then went private.
Mazboot. Aramex has a whole story. Yeah, and we've had Fadi on the show here, and we talked about, you know, exactly. I mean, it's had the full dynamic, and it went public abroad and then relisted back here in Dubai. So they've also had their own journey. But I feel that if there is potentially a public market for smaller companies, that could be interesting because it enables investors to cash out or at least have liquid currency. And not every company will be able to make the journey of going pan-GCC and international, etc.
It's tough. Again, why? Because you need liquidity both ways. Even when you're listed, you need to have a liquid market. And again, if you don't have a liquid market and you're listed, it's even worse. So you better be private than list in a place where there's no liquidity and depth of market. So that's also that creates an opportunity and ambiguity for the founders to really decide how to grow the company. And I think the example of Anghami and the Arab world is an example of a listing that didn't do well.
Yes.
You know, it was a SPAC, and I think we all know the story.
Yes.
It wasn't as successful as hopefully we all anticipated.
Yes.
But yeah, so the issue is that exit is an issue. You have to find a buyer, or you have to become sustainable and cash flow positive after year five for you to become a brick and mortar business. Because some businesses can become, long-term viable, cash flow positive, and generating dividend for the owners as well.
I have a final question for you.
Yeah.
How do you, given how many things you're involved in at the same time, how do you prioritize? I mean, you have launched multiple verticals. You have your own investing. You're spending a couple of hours here there on Shark Tank. You have a lot going on, to put it very mildly. How do you prioritize each day when you wake up of what to work on? Because things hit you as well, I'm sure.
I've always surrounded myself with great people. And again, I think that's the key to success. The team takes on a lot of the heat, to be honest with you. So they take on all the responsibilities, the day-to-day work, and leading.
So that gives you the time?
Gives me the time to just...
And the mind frame to go and do things that you want to.
But again, what I'm doing is, it's not work. I'm enjoying what I'm doing.
I think
so. Do you say how you prioritize? I don't. I mean, I get on with what's needed at the time. Again, they're easy. They're three buckets or four buckets that I'm playing with. So today I wake up and say, I'm focusing on this. So I have a meeting in that particular area, and that's how it goes. But again, the key thing for me is to assign leaders for every bucket, for every vertical. And then those leaders are building the businesses.
Are there particular areas that come easier to than others? In other words, I can tell you in my job, there are certain parts of it that they flow. It's very easy. I feel very much. And there are other parts, especially when it comes to some operational parts, that frankly don't flow as much. As I rely on a team that's very strong, I hope. I get involved as needed, but I don't feel as passionate about it.
Yeah.
Do you get that same feeling, or have you deliberately chosen verticals where you feel all of them? I have that feeling when I talk to you, frankly, that a lot of these things are really a reflection of your own personality and interest. So that's why I think they're not silos, they're verticals, and they kind of,
They're connected. They're connected.
And yeah. I think you're the connection, quite frankly, in many ways.
Yeah.
But are there any areas where you're like, this, okay, I'll do it, but saraha, does it all come the same way?
Everything I don't like to do, I get people to do it, to be honest with you, because I know I would fail.
You should learn from
that. Know, honestly, it's about, people make fun of me because I was in a media job and I don't know how to use Excel.
Yeah.
Media is about
brilliant.
Numbers.
That says something about you.
I don't know how to use Excel, honestly. Maybe I can add three numbers and say,
I'm sure
it.
You can.
But honestly, I mean, it's about people at the end of the day. And it's about creating the culture where great people can thrive and succeed and do what they're best doing.
So do you feel you approach this more from the heart than analytically? Because obviously you need a bit of both, right?
Yeah. It's of course at the heart. Everything is at the heart. Everything has to be done with emotion and with culture and with a great place to work environment and what have you. But it's all about strategy as well. So I would say analytical in the sense of, where are we going? What are we doing? And how are we going to lead that industry and be great at it?
And I think you clearly have a very good sense of breaking it down to its essentials. I mean, you asked me a few questions coming here about my own business. And it was very obvious. You asked questions that probably took us a couple of years to, you broke it down to the two to three things that will make it either work or not. And I think that's probably is a skill that's most needed when you're analyzing new businesses.
Look, I was blessed to work in an industry where you're exposed to so many industries. I mean, in my 30 years of advertising and media, I've worked in automotive, hospitality, perfumes, luxury, banking, telco, you name it. So when you work with so many industries and solve so many problems when it comes to marketing, you've seen it all, kind of. And they're all, the complexity of marketing is always is pivoting around the same issues.
That's a good point.
How do you come up with an idea? How do you make yourself different versus your competitors? How do you break through in a cluttered environment? Who are your consumers? How are you talking? It's the same thing for businesses. So in whichever industry you're in, it's always about solving the same issues. How to connect what you're doing with your consumers, with the people that are buying your product, and how do you create magic? How do you make the connection and create magic? And magic is what we're here to do. You're creating magic in your environment.
I hope so.
When people come to you, they feel something. So, because of your hard work, because of what you've done,
is it more difficult to break out of the clutter today with social media, with digitalization than it used to be 20 or 30 years ago? Or you think it's just the medium transformed, but it's the same challenge?
It's now it's easier, of course, because you are, it's mass communication, but more personalization.
Yes.
Before it was difficult to personalize. Today, with social media, with data, we're all giving our data to social platforms.
Yes.
So they're being able to sense things a bit more bespoke. Again, it can be a bit spooky to you sometimes, as you know, when you click on something, you start to see 100%. Stuff happening to you. But that's the world we're living in today. So yeah, it's easier and it's cheaper, because a lot of time, long time ago, there was a lot of wastage in what you used to do.
But our attention spans are more divided.
They're more divided. But again, with the phone, we're constantly on. You know, unfortunately, it's constantly on. And we're constantly being bombarded with things. And it is what it is. I think we're changing. I think consumers are changing. We're adapting. But I think we can all do with a bit of less, you know, usage of phone and social media.
Eli, that's been great. Thank you
great,
so much.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming on. If you've enjoyed this episode, you'll enjoy my conversation with Cyril Zamit, the former director of Design Days Dubai, and also my conversation with two generations of Naashes, founders of Naash Gallery, where we talk about the role of design fairs in establishing a collectible design market. Thank you for joining me on the Lighthouse Conversations. I'm Hesham Montasser. We're produced by Chirag Desai. You can connect with us on Instagram at @thelighthouse_podcast for behind-the-scenes videos and more. We'll see you again very soon.